Welcome to The Commentary. I'm Mark Bertrandt. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church.
And I'm Cameron Brooks. I'm a poet and a musician at the church. The Commentary is a weekly conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace. And in this episode, we are going to be talking about reading. Pastor Mark, in a recent sermon of yours, you referenced a couple of articles that brought to our attention the downfall of reading among students in particular, that's right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a panic going on in the media, fueled by academia, because a lot of professors are saying that students are arriving at college really ill-equipped for reading, particularly they haven't read whole books, apparently. Just the practice of reading has fallen off. So there was a piece in the Journal of Higher Education that asked the question, is this the end of reading? And a lot of other pieces followed in its wake. There was one in The Atlantic in early October that talked about this, that described, students have never completed all of the reading assignments, but this feels really different, where it seems like even at elite colleges, students are showing up with a real lack of ability and are kind of overwhelmed at the thought that they're suddenly being asked to read whole books. That's just too extreme. It's beyond what they can handle. And then in the New York Times, there was an op-ed by one of these professors, a writing professor, who confessed that he'd gone from, in his classes before, I think he was assigning 9 books a semester, and he'd whittled that down to 0, and it just stopped assigning. He said, the last 4 years, I haven't assigned any books, and, he talked about some of the reasons why, and why he thought the students were not wrong to be not reading. He felt like they were responding rationally to the cues they were getting from their culture. But even so, he resolved to start assigning at least one book again. So a lot of anxiety, and it just got me thinking, because as someone who cares a lot about books, about reading, and certainly as a Christian, we're people of the book, the idea that not only is literacy in decline, but that the students at elite colleges who will go on to be the ruling class of our nation are not readers is a little bit terrifying.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think most listeners of this podcast will agree that it's terrifying. I think most listeners will also understand that you and I enjoy reading. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, and are ourselves writers. But I want to give this argument a little bit of credence and think about it from the perspective of that professor. He said there are cultural cues that the students are reading. Do you have any sense of what he's talking about there?
A little bit. I think what he has in mind is that, people respond to what they see valued in the world around them, and they adjust their behavior accordingly. And so he's saying that his students see a world where reading isn't valued or rewarded, other behaviors are. And so they don't put a value on the activity of reading. So I think there's, we could say, almost a two-part component here, that where on the one hand, there's the idea that you're not equipped to read, and so you're a little bit terrified of having all of these assignments. But then the other side of it is being indignant that you're expected to do this thing. You're not good at it, but why should you be? What's the point of it? He doesn't make this case, but I think it might be parallel to if students were suddenly showing up and being expected to do math in their heads, they would be, unable perhaps to do it, but also indignant that they were being asked because they have calculators. Why do they need skills like that? And it seems as if reading, especially deep reading, has become one of those activities that people just don't see the point of, really.
Yeah, especially when there are so many other forms of media on offer nowadays. I think maybe that's something the professor had in mind. I didn't get to the whole article, but when I look around, anyway, I see more value being placed on visual media, whether it's entertainment or education.
Right.
And certainly when I was a teacher, a high school teacher for a couple of years, there was pressure to have visual components with your teaching. You couldn't just show up and lecture or hand out a text, because some students, all students really, probably prefer something visual to look at. And that's something I think about a lot, is that shift from the word-based culture or the word-centered culture society to the visual. And I think, who was it? Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Neil Postman.
Yeah, that's one of the arguments he makes in that book, is that shift was happening way back in the, I don't know when he wrote that, in the 60s or 70s or something. And I see some of the fallout of that even today with our wild visual digital technologies that continue to grow and take our attention.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right, that there are new forms. And even in education, if you were going to learn something, I think for a lot of people, the idea of getting a book about it and reading it cover to cover would not be the way you'd go about it. You know, you would go online,
YouTube.
If you're older, you go to YouTube.
Yeah.
If you're younger, maybe TikTok.
Yeah, right.
And you would learn what you need to know there. And, you know, if you needed to supplement it, you could do some Google searches or something to fill in the blanks. But the idea of, you know, getting that knowledge out of long form books is a lot more alien, and let's say it's less, I don't say less necessary, but I mean, there was a time when that was your only option,
right?
You know, and now it is not your only option, and you can bone up on a lot of stuff without having to crack open the books. And so I think from a utilitarian standpoint, you could certainly make the case that this isn't the most efficient way for me to gain the minimum amount of knowledge to make it through, you know, tests or something like that. And I think that was what the writing professor was saying, was that, you know, the students are kind of doing what makes sense given what the expectations are.
Right. Well, we're talking about reading for knowledge and reading in the academic sphere. And yeah, maybe I do understand some of those concerns of the students, even that, well, if I can extract information from the internet faster than going through a whole book, why would I not do that? And there's something to be said perhaps for reading for that purpose, reading to gain a specific knowledge. But I wonder about other forms of reading outside of academia.
Right.
And I guess, like you mentioned at the beginning, Christians, we think of Christians as people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any case to be made for reading, deep reading or leisurely reading outside of the quest for knowledge, say?
No, that's a good question. I mean, you know, there's a part of me that wants to push back on the idea that all reading isn't for knowledge ultimately, you know, that even when we read for pleasure, part of the pleasure is that gaining of understanding that comes through even in fiction, you know. But yeah, I think there are a lot of different reasons why people read. This is the tip of an iceberg, right? The NEA for years has been publishing, you know, studies and that sort of thing on declining rates of literacy. And, you know, this isn't a new phenomena. People have been reading less, and certainly they've been doing a lot less, quote unquote, literary reading, serious reading. Obviously, we are reading texts. We are reading, you know, short things on the internet. It's not that that we're functionally illiterate, but that higher form of literacy, where you're able to process complex thoughts and make connections and even create prose of your own, that is surprisingly on the wane. You know, if you've ever received an email from, well, anyone, you know that literacy isn't all that it could be. And ironically, I think that's one of the selling points of artificial intelligence for a lot of people is that it promises to do the grunt work of, you know, making your emails or communications seem literate, you know, filling in the blanks that are necessary to make it seem like a person who knows what they're doing crafted these sentences instead of the person who's actually doing them. And so,
did you see the recent ad from Apple?
No.
On this, I mean, it's exactly what you're talking about. It's kind of funny, but I hate that it's funny. There's a guy in an office typing an email to his boss, and it's showing him, he's on his phone just smashing away, and you can't really, I mean, you probably could read it, but it's clearly a bunch of nonsense, and he doesn't know what he's doing, and you can see some emojis in the email, and he's talking to himself as he's typing it, and he goes, I'm going to need to, like, whiz this up or something, and of course, there's this nice artificial intelligence edit button at the bottom. So he clicks it and it automatically rewrites the email and it cleans it up. And then the signature at the end is best regards, Wallace. And and it sends it over to his boss and it just shows his boss open up the email and all he says is Wallace. And he looks over across the office and he looks at the employee like, wow, I didn't know he was capable of such fine writing or something like that. It's surprising. But the point is that this guy has no clue how to communicate in this way anymore and needs the robot to mediate that experience for him.
Yeah.
Well, that to me is concerning.
Wallace probably went to an elite university and
could have
never read a book, you know? Right. Not too long ago, the novelist Curtis Sittenfeld did this experiment where apparently her books had been used to train an AI model. And so she took a set of prompts and wrote a story of her own based on those prompts, and then the same prompts were fed into the AI model, and it generated a story in the style of Curtis Sittenfeld. And so you could read the two side by side, which I did, you know, interested in the phenomena. And I felt like it was very clear right from the beginning which piece had been written by the human and which by AI. But it was a lot more convincing than it would have been a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing, is the tools become more efficient. A lot of the utilitarian reasons why literacy might be of value do feel probably as if they're not as pressing as they once were, maybe even irrelevant. And so, you know, I think there is it isn't just a panic. I think it's a real trend to observe, and it does raise some concerns, because no matter how good the language model is and how convincing it is as a piece of communication you might send to someone else, it isn't thinking for you. And you yourself are not processing those things. So you don't benefit in any way except the utilitarian reputation boost that Wallace gets. And that, I think, is the real problem, right? That if all that matters is creating the impression of knowledge, then you don't need to go through so much effort. But if the reality of knowledge is important, if there's a value in actually understanding and being able to understand, you know, a long form text, then not having that experience, that's a big deal. In the sermon, you know, I shared the story of my brother who bragged that he had managed to get out of high school only having read two books. And when I quizzed him on it, I quickly discovered he'd only read one because his grasp of the other was pretty shaky.
Yeah.
So it's not a new phenomena, and there have always been people who are less interested in reading than others. But I think what I'm interested in really is more like our attitudes towards this news, whether we see it as like a problem to be addressed or as, you know, hey, it's no big deal. You said earlier that, you know, you and I are both biased because we're writers and readers, but I think you'd agree that you have felt, and I know I have felt, a certain degree of anxiety about my own reading as a result of, you know, being online and having access to these tools. I worry sometimes that I'm not as sharp as I was, and it's not just because I'm getting older, that it's not as easy to immerse myself in a, you know, 500-page book than it once was. And so I don't think we can draw a line and say, you know, readers are on one side and non-readers are on the other. I mean, I think that this is something that everyone is affected by, and there's got to be implications, you know, for all of us.
Yeah, certainly. Part of the reason I jumped at the idea of discussing this with you is because I have concerns for myself, selfish concerns that I resonate with those students. Not that I don't want to read or am intimidated necessarily at the thought, but that, yes, when I am trying to read, I find it more difficult too. And I am being constantly told in the workplace, hey, just use this AI tool to summarize this thing for you. You don't even have to read it. You don't have to write this. We have these tools now. And that this is a part of your professional development.
Right.
So yeah, there's a part of me that's very concerned about these things. And I also see reading though as a remedy to that. So I mean, maybe it's a circular argument, but I think that if there's a concern that, well, there are all these distractions and that are whittling away at our attention, reading is one way to combat that, because it forces you to pay attention. And maybe you struggle at that, as I certainly do. But it's, I saw somebody, of course it was a tweet or something. Of course I gotta bring in a tweet. But he said it's an overstatement for sure, but the only way to fix your attention span, he said, is to put your phone away and read a book. And he was posing reading a book, full-length book in particular, as a solution to, or an aid anyway, to the problem. So, yeah, I don't know where to go from here. I was gonna mention a book that I'm currently reading.
Yeah.
So, Leif Anger. Some listeners might have read his book, Peace Like a River, which came out several years ago, but I'm reading his new novel called I Cheerfully Refuse, which is a dystopian novel that takes place on Lake Superior. It's a really cool setting. It's obviously in the future a little ways, but the main protagonist and his wife are trying to survive in these dismal times, very depressing, bleak times. And one way you know that civilization is in decline, according to the narrator anyway, is that people are increasingly illiterate. They don't read anymore. Some can't read, or they don't care about it. There's a newspaper, but notoriously it has lots of typos. So they talk about, well, is this newspaper worth anything? The Mosquito is what it's called. But they always have typos in their headlines. And it's an interesting way to describe the fall of civilization in the future as a fall away from literacy. And it has me thinking really about the connections between the written word, language really, human language, and truth or reality. And this is not the only dystopian novel that sees that connection between truth, reality, and language. And in some dystopian novels, you see the manipulation of language to manipulate reality. And I think at bottom, that's why I really care about this discussion and reading, because the written word is a connection to reality, or can be anyway, and a way for us to see and interpret the world.
Well, I think, you know, there's an argument that I make at church about the confession of faith, where I argue that one of the values of having a confession of faith is that it serves as an anchor outside of time, that we have a tendency to interpret everything, including scripture, through a 21st century grid. And by having a commitment to this earlier interpretation, we are forced out of that tendency, or at least it's challenged, right? So I think that a lot of the books that are not being assigned to these students or to students in general have a similar kind of function because they're written in the past. They reflect past ways of thinking, complex ways of thinking, maybe make cases for things that today would be out of favor. But there's a real value in having to encounter those things, in having some sort of a check and balance against just the way we think now. And so I feel like there's a lot at stake in the loss of access to those, let's say, primary sources, right? Because if you read, for example, Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky, and you should, what you will derive is different from what AI will summarize when you ask it, what is this book about? Because the tools of the 21st century propagate the values of the 21st century by and large. And so there is a tendency to smooth over things or present things sort of the way we think of them now. And if you read Dostoevsky, he does not think of things the way that we think of them now. And that's only one example. You know, I think there's a huge library of challenging and fascinating books out there that are intentionally part of our education for that very reason, that they bring us into contact with those minds of the past, what used to be called the Great Conversation. And increasingly, I think we live in times where we want the conversation to sort of begin and end here. And we don't want those other people to have a voice in it. And so I see more than just, you know, it hurts the student to have, you know, a declining rate of literacy. I think it hurts all of us as a society to have educated people who aren't actually schooled by the Great Conversation in the way that they ought to have been, you know. And I think that's, again, that's making the point generally. I think there's some specific things we could say about the church, but just for the purposes of this conversation, this episode, just generally speaking, I think there's a value to literacy and encouraging literacy that is good for Christians and non-Christians alike. It's good for humans. And when we see that in decline, it should be a concern for all of us, especially if it's in decline, but only the old people think that's a problem. You know, that maybe is the other component that worries me, is that the teachers see a problem, but maybe the students do not. And certainly these days, how the students see things seems to be a lot more important than how the teachers do.
Mm-hmm. One last question is, I was thinking about a potential listener out there who has listened to this whole conversation, but yet maybe hasn't bought it and doesn't read frequently, doesn't care for reading, or somebody in our lives, you know, pick anybody. My brother is a freshman in college, rather, and so he's probably one of those students that the article's talking about. And I don't know if he loves reading.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what his experience of reading was like in high school. And sometimes I wish that I could pass off books to him and,
right,
you got to read this thing. And I always give books as gifts for Christmas presents, even if I know the person I'm gifting doesn't necessarily want to read it. But how do you instill the love of reading to in someone who doesn't necessarily care? Especially that argument you just were exploring was all about civilization. We're talking about society. Some people are like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I've got a life to live.
Right. And admittedly, you probably won't awaken many minds by saying, but don't you want to be civilized? And, you know, let's be honest. It's not that everybody has to be a compulsive reader. You know, of course not. I think that there should at least, though, be like a minimum expectation, certainly in the context of education, right? That if we jettison that, you know, you might go the rest of your life and very infrequently read a book. Mm-hmm. But while you are in school, the idea that you would get through school without doing it, like you're missing an opportunity, right? Like if there was one time where this could happen, this would be the one. Now, I know from my own experiences that oftentimes the way that we approach this in school not only doesn't encourage people to be readers, but maybe inoculates them against it, you know, makes them think this is the worst thing ever. And as soon as I'm out of school, I'll never look at a book again. So, you know, I think that there's a limit maybe to sort of our romanticized view of education where, you know, if you just read aloud to people and they'll get the beauty of it and be lifelong readers, maybe not. But I think having some expectations and encouraging people that it's worth the effort is maybe enough, you know, and then also not being, you know, an obnoxious, judgmental elitist towards people who are just not going to be readers.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. In the same way that there are people who, you know, will never read fiction, they'll only read nonfiction, right? Or they'll only read prose, not poetry, or vice versa, you know, whatever it is. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of variety. I think the big point, though, is that language is a gift. Creativity is a gift, and we benefit from these things in ways that are precious to us as a culture and are really precious to us as a church. You know, and I think maybe that's a conversation for another day, but the difficulty that we've been talking about is multiplied immensely when you think about the context of being interpreters of scripture, because the thing that reading instills, especially good reading, is the ability to interpret, you know, to make sense of the words. And anytime you're called upon to interpret, everything you've read up to that point is helping you to be a good interpreter. You know, if you're a good reader, if you are applying yourself, I think like everything that you've read makes you a better reader of everything you will read. Mm-hmm. Right? It has a cumulative effect. So if we want to be good interpreters, good thinkers, good communicators, this is a necessity.